We're having a special class or series. We'll see how it goes. And on the history, evolvement of the oral tradition and the rabbinic law. So we'll begin with Moshe at Sinai. When Moshe goes up Mount Sinai, so we know he's going to receive the Torah, right? He's going to receive two Torahs, the written law and the oral law. It's impossible to understand the written Torah without the oral Torah. If you read the written Torah without the oral Torah, so you end up with laws like an eye for an eye, a hand for a hand. So you could say maybe that's good, right? But our tradition is it's not that way. If you read the written Torah without the oral Torah, so then every day you'll put a piece of jewelry on your forehead, between your eyes, not on your forehead, right? Tefillin would go right here. Ve'yu l'totafot. You should put a piece of jewelry between your eyes. Judaism looks very different if you don't have the oral tradition. What does Shabbos consist of? Al yetze ish mim komo biyom ha-shevi'i. Sit in your place and don't get up all of that seventh day. Wow, that's an interesting Shabbos. Just sit down, no moving. Okay, take the Torah without the oral law, and you have a totally different Torah. Moshe is given the written Torah and the oral law. Okay? Written Torah and oral law. The oral interpretation. And when he's given the oral interpretation, he's also given the laws of derivation. We have 13 laws of inference that are quoted in the opening paragraph of the Medrash Sifrei. And we say it every morning, some of us. Rabbi Yishmael Omer, Bishlosh Yisrei Midot HaTorah Nidreshet. There are 13 laws, logical laws of inference that are used to derive from the Torah. Bekal v'chomer, what is that? A fortiori. What's a fortiori? Okay, come on, what's a kal v'chomer?
Even more so.
Okay, so let's say Daniel Cooperman is a phenomenal fighter. He knows he's a black belt, and I am a little wimp, I can't do anything. But if I can lift this telephone book, so certainly Daniel Cooperman, who's 10 times as strong as me, can lift this telephone book. Yeah? That's a fortiori. That's kal v'chomer. That's the term for it. Yes. Even more so. Your even more so is, in legal terms, it's called a fortiori. So if he is 10 times as strong as I am, so then if I can lift this, so we begin by establishing severity. He is more severe, I am more light. So if I, who is lighter, can do this task, then he who is more severe certainly can do the task. So if we look at the laws of the Torah, we try to understand using looking at the Torah, we say, which is more severe? And if this law applies in this case, which is less severe, certainly it should apply in that case, which is more severe. So that's one law of inference. It's called kal v'chomer. If we analyze it in depth, we will see that kal v'chomer actually breaks down to three types of kal v'chomer. But we won't go into that today. That's advanced Talmud. I mean, we'd like to think kal v'chomer is very simple. Yeah, if I could and he's stronger, then certainly he could. If the Torah says that when you are a shomer chinam, when you watch for nothing, so then you have very little obligations. You're doing the guy a favor. Nonetheless, you're obligated to pay if you were negligent. I tell you, hey, watch this for me. I'm going out for an hour. And you just leave it behind and someone walks off with it. So that's gross negligent. And Shomer Chinam is obligated for that. So what would be the Shomer Sachar? What would be if I paid you and I said, I'll pay you for the hour to watch this? It's a kal v'chomer that you'd be obligated to pay for gross negligence, right? We expect more from you if I'm paying for you, if I'm paying for your time, if I'm paying for the service, right? So here we see a simple example of a kal v'chomer, right? This is more severe than that, and if this law applies here, if this severe law applies here, it obviously applies in the more severe case. So that's one law of inference. It's very logical. If you would study the 13 laws of inference, you'd see they're all very logical. They are actually logical laws of inference. Let's see. Hayotzei min haklal lo lamed al tzmo yatza, ela lelamed al haklal kulo yatza. If we have a series, and then let's take an example from modern day, and then we'll take an example from Torah. I say to my kids, no one's allowed to go out of the house right now. They're doing construction outside. It's very dangerous. No one's allowed to go out. And then I say to one of the kids, if you go out, you're not getting dessert. So I didn't say that to all the kids. I said a general rule to all the kids. No one's allowed to go out. And then I see the three-year-old eyeing the door, and I tell him, if you go out, you're not getting dessert. So then I can infer that any of the kids that go out won't get dessert. Right? Because I've made a generalization. All of them shouldn't go out. And then one of them gave me an indication he's thinking of it, and I said, there's construction out there, it's dangerous. If you go out, you're not getting dessert. So then the rest of them can infer that the same is going to happen to them. So that's a rule that we say in the laws of Torah, that if you had a klal, you had a generalization, and then a yotze min haklal, one went out and was given another detail, so then you say, lo lelamed al atzmo yatzah, it didn't come to teach only about itself, lo lelamed al haklal kulo yatzah, it came to infer about the rest of the rules. So the Torah gives us a whole list of women that were prohibited from marrying. And then it says about one of them that if a person does it, then he'll get kares. He gets cut off. He gets a very severe punishment. Torah doesn't say it about the other ones. So then we infer that that's a punishment for all of them. The Torah gave you a long list and said, all these you shouldn't marry. You're not allowed to marry your aunt. You're not allowed to marry your sister. You're not allowed to marry your daughter. You're not allowed to marry your mother. You're not allowed to whole list. Okay? And then it says, and about one of them it says, that the punish is kares, the punishment. So you understand that all of them are kares. Torah says, don't do tasks on Shabbos. And then it says, about one of those tasks, that's punishable by the death penalty. So then you understand that all the tasks are punishable by the death penalty. The Torah gave you a generalization, and then gave you a detail about one of them. So you understand, it came to teach you about all of them. So that's, okay, these are laws of inference. Now sometimes the laws contradict one another. If you use this law of inference, you come up with this conclusion. If you use that law of inference, you come up with an opposite conclusion. Which one do you use? Okay, so I gave you two examples of laws of inference. There are 13 laws of inference. A little bit more, but we'll say 13 for now. So when Moshe was in Shemayim, he started asking the Ribbon Shel Olam, what will I do when this question comes up? What will I do when that question comes up? And Hashem told him, here are the laws of derivation. Use them and apply them. So Moshe sat down and started taking a case-by-case scenario and seeing how to apply the laws of derivation. So he took case one that it doesn't say in the Torah, and he started proving. And he brought proof one, and he brought proof two, and he brought proof three, and he brought proof four, and he's bringing proof after proof. He ends up with 49 proofs that that case should be prohibited. Okay? He finishes proving it, and then he starts thinking again, and he can come up with another 49 proofs that should be permissible. So he turns to God and says, okay, I used these laws of derivation, but applied this way, I can come up with this conclusion. Applied that way, I can come up with that conclusion. Which way is right? And there Hashem tells him, okay, that's where you have to train a court. You should have 70 elders. You should have a high court, a lower court. Train as many rabbis as you can, and they will learn it. They will learn these laws of derivation. And after they've learned them and mastered them, which we said could take 40 years, and they really are impartial. They're not going based on social whims. They're not going based on fads. They're not going based on a feeling. Gee, I think in the name of women's liberty, the role should be this way. I think that things have been too lenient lately. People on Shabbos should really sit in their place and not walk around. It does say, Al yetzei ish mimkomo, just sit in place on Shabbos, right? It has nothing to do with that. The I doesn't show up there. Meaning the laws of derivation are all about what is the Torah trying to tell me. I'll tell you a phenomenal story that I just had this week. I taught my brother-in-law how to circumcise. Okay, I have a brother-in-law who was my chavrusa before he got married. And I taught him for years. I've been teaching him. And he's good at it. And as all mohalim, starting mohalim, have difficulty getting anyone to give him their child to circumcise, so he also, you know, he's starting out, he has a one here, one there, but it's hard to get people to trust you. So I told him that when I'll have a boy, if I will merit to have a boy, then I will be honored for him to circumcise the boy. So, lo and behold, 8 days ago, we were fortunate enough to have a boy. So I called him up and I said, you know, sharpen your blades. Get ready. Fine. So he's getting ready. 2 days ago, I visited one of the senior rabbis that are around today, and I said to him out of respect, being that I've been studying by him, I said out of respect, I wanted to tell the Rav that I'm doing a circumcision on Thursday. I don't want to invite the Rav. I don't know how old he is, in the 80s or 90s. I said, yeah, I know it's hard to travel out to Kohav Yaakov. I'm not inviting because I don't think it's right that the Rav should strain himself coming all the way out there. Mm-hmm. So I'm purposely not saying the name right now. Off record, I'll tell you who was. He said, I appreciate it. It's really not easy. I understand you know who's doing the circumcision. So I said, well, actually, I wasn't planning on doing it myself. I was planning, there's a student who I taught, and I think it'll be a very important step forward for him in his livelihood and making a parnasa and making a reputation for himself. So I would like to give him the opportunity to do it. So he looks at me and says, no. So I spent about 3 to 5 minutes arguing with him, Nalaha, and I still don't understand why. I'm still going to have to study this again. But he said, no, your mitzvah, you don't give to someone else. It'll help him. Let him find help a different way. And I walked away and I said to myself, okay, there's something I didn't understand right about the laws, about the concept of a father circumcising his own child. Because when I learned the halacha, I see the preference in it. I don't see that that preference outweighs the kindness of helping a person get a livelihood. I thought that outweighs this, and he's telling me not that way. So I walked away and I didn't understand him, and he didn't have time to explain it to me. So it was the end of his day. I couldn't keep the rub. So even though I questioned him for about 3 minutes trying to understand him, and then I understood, bottom line, he's saying this is clearly not the way I understood it. Goodbye. Okay. So I walked away and I didn't have time to get clarity. I called another rub I studied under. And I said, this is the story and I don't understand it. And he also didn't have a lot of time. And he also said very clearly, no, you shouldn't give up your mitzvah. Circumcise your own son. And again, I argued with him, and I have sources why I thought the halacha should be differently. And he said, no. And again, I didn't have the time to question him. He had people waiting for him, and I still don't understand why. So it was clear to me that this is what I'm going to have to do, even though I don't understand it. And just trying to get clarity in the halacha, I called the rabbi who I studied circumcision under, who actually taught me to be a moel a decade ago or a little bit more. And I asked him. And he also said the same thing. So now, I don't understand the halacha that way. Till today, I don't know why they're saying that. In all honesty, I'm missing something. I sat down, I went over the Shulchan Aruch again, I went over the commentaries again, I went over again. I don't understand it. I really don't understand. But now I see I'm missing something. I thought I knew the laws of circumcision well. Now I discovered there's something in the laws that I'm missing as far as the mitzvah of a father doing his own son. So I hope I will glean from their wisdom and understand it. But I'm just saying, you see that when you speak to people who are half a century older than me, who have studied longer than me, so then they're all coming with the same conclusion. So even though I had something which I didn't understand correctly, after questioning and asking and learning, Bizrat Hashem, now I will understand. I don't yet understand it, because I don't understand the reasoning behind what they said. But you see that it goes in an order. I've had questions like that in my life where I asked, and every one of the old rabbis, I'm talking about people who've studied halacha for years and have experience and have tradition, they all came back with the same answer. And even though looking at the text, I didn't understand that answer, but studying and accepting their tradition and learning more, I finally understood where they were coming from. And I could give you many examples, but I'm just saying I gave you one example that was relevant this week. So when we speak about tradition, it's not just, hey, what would I like it to be? It's I'm working with the system. I'm working with an impartial understanding. If you asked me, I thought it was a much bigger mitzvah to give my brother-in-law the mitzvah today to do the circumcision. But it's not a question of what I think. It's a question of what does the halacha want from me? And you know what? When I called my brother-in-law, I said to him, look, I'm very sorry to tell you, but I had a very surprising conversation today with Rabbi so-and-so. So you know what his answer was to me? He said to me, look, if this is the way God wants us to be Jews, so then this is what we have to do, and you're doing the circumcision, period. Meaning he didn't start arguing with me, maybe this, maybe that, maybe you should say. He said, look, we're doing a circumcision to do a mitzvah. If this is the better way to do the mitzvah, obviously you're going to do it. Meaning there was no argument between us. It wasn't that. I'm just trying to point out that when we learn halacha and we try to adhere to halacha, it's not a question of what I want. It's not a question of what he wants. We both preferred he would do it. I, because I love him. I want him to do well. I think it's good for him. And him, because he also, you know, it's a step forward. Bottom line, today I did my son's circumcision. I let him do all the preps. I let him do everything before and after. Bandaging the baby, taking care of the baby, everything but the circumcision itself. Because if that's the halacha, what am I going to do? And I don't understand it yet. I'm telling you, there's something here in the halacha I don't understand. I have to study. I have to get a better grasp of it. But that's why we study and we keep studying. That's why I keep saying it takes 40 years, the Talmud says, before you really understand what's going on. It's a specific example. I gave a specific example. But when we speak generally, I told you I could give you many examples. But when we speak generally about the system in the Torah, so Moshe was taught a system with the laws of derivation, and then you have to approach it impartially. You have to approach it with cold logic and say, okay, what does the Torah try to tell me here? And that means working very hard to analyze it from every aspect, to analyze what's more severe, what's more lenient. It's not always as obvious as the cases I gave. Very often you have two cases in Torah, and it's not so clear which one's more stringent than the other. And there are different aspects to each case. And then you have to figure out, okay, which one, how do I rule in each case? So that takes a lot of work. And at the end of the day, working with that system, with an impartial court, and then Hashem says, go with the majority opinion, not based on whims, not based on fads, based on an impartial understanding. The Mishnah says, Madiot yotzot, pufot, parsiot, mechurbalot, I might have gotten it backwards. The Elashedbu Chachamim Bove says, in Persia, they wear their scarves one way, the women. In Mead, they wear it another way. So the halacha of what's a permissible way to wear your scarf so that you're not carrying it in public domain, each rabbi addressed his locale. All the rabbis, the Mishnah say, agree to the same concept, just each rabbi addressed the dresses that women wore where he was rabbi. So the Mishnah says, obviously we're discussing the fad that we're contending with, but we're using the same system. If a rabbi called me just before the summer and said to me, there's a new fad. People are cutting their hair short on the side, and in the middle they're leaving it long. So I didn't know what he was talking about at the time. Now I know what he's talking about. And he started asking me, how do we address this from a public perspective, from a halachic perspective? We understand there are two questions here. Is there a prohibition of cutting our pace? And is there a prohibition of dressing like non-Jews dress? Because an example of that is in haircuts, where if there's... So we started going through the whole system. Obviously, we're dealing with a fad that's today, but the system of addressing it is based on the Talmud, which discusses haircuts 2,000-3,000 years ago. We have a question today about artificial insemination. A woman gets pregnant, right? They take the seed from the man. They inject it into the woman. Is that called that he is the father of the baby? Is that baby going to be a Kohen if the father was a Kohen? The two did not live together intimately, right? Is the baby a Kohen? Does the baby have a Jewish father? If it's a girl, can she marry a Kohen? You know, a girl whose father is not Jewish can't marry a Kohen, right? So, even though she's Jewish, but she may not marry a Kohen. So does that baby have a Jewish father? What about if it's in vitro fertilization, right? They fertilize the baby outside in a test tube, the embryo starts developing, and then they put it in the woman. Is that baby that was fertilized outside the woman, is he Jewish? Does he have to undergo conversion? Is he a Kohen? Is he named after his father? Does he inherit his father?
Is he a person?
No, that's a good question, right? If I clone a person, is he a person? So all these questions, believe it or not, were addressed in the Talmud. But you have to learn a lot of Talmud. So how come the Talmud addressed it? How come Maimonides spoke about an airplane? How come the Mishnah in Olos discusses the capacity to fly over a graveyard? They didn't have that capacity. Because they were working to distill the halacha to the point where I understand it, irrespective of the facts I'm living with today. I have to understand the Talmud discusses levitation. The Talmud did not have a way of levitating. And yet the Talmud openly discusses airplanes and the capacity to levitate over things. Why? Because if I have an understanding of Torah, I have to have a mastery of the details down to the nitty-gritty of what's the Torah telling me, irrespective of my capacity today. Why did the Talmud discuss a woman getting pregnant in a bathtub? Did it happen so often that a woman got pregnant in a bathtub? The Talmud says it doesn't happen often, right? But that halacha teaches us so much about artificial insemination.
That was the example they used for artificial insemination.
Correct. Correct. So they didn't have what we have, you know, get it in a capsule, inject it. So they spoke about it in a bathtub, but the Talmud discusses it. So when we're working to understand halacha today, we're working with a system that goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Even though we've evolved, our opinions are not shaped by the fad of the time. The questions we deal with are shaped by the time or the fad of the time. Today we have to deal with the question of a man on the moon. When does he make Kiddush? When does the day end? When does it begin? When does he say Kriya Shema? But we have to answer that question based on the Talmud. We look back at the sources and then we have to answer today's questions. You're on an airplane, right? I flew once on a fast day. So when does my fast end? You know, I'm on the plane. I keep seeing the sun. I'm traveling with or against the sun. Right? So when does the fast day end? So that happens to be discussed in halacha. You're counting Sefiras Omer, 49 days. Where does your day end and begin when you're traveling? So all these questions are addressed. So today, you're right, our response to today is going to deal with today's questions, but the source material for our answer is going to be in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, in our tradition.
Can you expedite a fast if you're in an airplane?
Yes, you can. You can have a much shorter fast if you fly, yes. Okay, so that was step number one, to understand that the oral tradition stems from tradition and a system. We're not inventing things, we're trying to work with a system. Now that system also allows us to deal with new questions that will arise. It's not like every question was covered in Talmud. There will be questions that are not. Even though the Talmud does discuss creating a cow that will give birth to a pig, which today they're working on, right? Will that pig be kosher? Can we eat pork? If we can have cows giving birth to pigs, right? And the Talmud does discuss creating animals from nothing, what we might call today cloning, an animal that does not come from parents. So if I can create a pig by cloning the pig, is that going to be kosher pork? Can I eat ham?
Is it parv?
Is it parv, right? Is it fleishik, right? So all these things the Talmud worked on based on a system. And that system is our tradition. And that's the system the Talmud is working so hard. Why do we have so many volumes here? Because there's a lot to discuss. There's a lot of details. And so when we look at the questions, we have to see their impartiality in the questions. And if you, on the contrary, the Talmud says that if a rabbi was partial, then he wouldn't be able to be a part of the court. And how did they gauge partiality? It says, let's say the court has to decide whether to make this year a leap year or not. So it says the high priest could not participate in that court. Why? Because the high priest knows in the back of his mind that come Yom Kippur, 7 months from now, he's going to have to dunk in the mikveh, right? 5 times on Yom Kippur. If he makes it into a leap year, Yom Kippur will be a month later into the winter. It's going to be a colder mikveh to dunk into. So the Talmud says, even though he's so holy, he's the high priest. You'd think he's impartial, right? The Talmud says about his bath, right? One day in the year, he's going to be a little bit colder going into the mikveh. And nonetheless, the Talmud says that makes him partial. And so that disqualifies him from the halachic process of deciding whether to make the year a leap year or not. So you're asking a question about all of Israel. Are we changing the calendar? Is there going to be another month of Adar? You'd think he's the high priest. He's so holy. The rabbis say he is disqualified. That's called that he is partial. So that's how careful the rabbis were in their halachic process to discern where their partiality lies. I sometimes get halachic questions where I say, I am partial. Don't ask me. It affects me, or I feel like my emotions here are very involved. I can't answer that question. We're going to shift it to someone else. They asked me in shul a few years ago, am I, in our shul, am I supposed to always get the aliyah of Chasan Torah, right? So there, some shuls do and some shuls don't. They wanted to know what we're going to do in our shul. So I said, look, I'm partial because I'm going to say don't give it to me. But maybe I'm wrong. So I said, let's pick a rabbi, someone that's unbiased. Because if you're asking me, then the answer is don't give it to me. Give it to someone else.
You suggesting that is also a partiality.
I said, we'll find a rabbi. I don't have to ask. You could ask. Someone should ask. But let's get someone else to decide. Because my first response is, don't give it to me. What do I need it for? What do I need people looking and saying, oh, every year he gets it. I'd rather other people get it. I don't need that headache, right? But that doesn't mean I'm right. So I'm partial the other way. Okay. I said, it's not right. I should decide. Let's give it to someone else. And I could give you a lot of examples that way. So our attempts, we are attempting, I'm not saying we're perfect, but we are attempting to achieve the truth through impartiality. And that's a pivotal point. And if we have that point, then we can start respecting the system. Without that point, then there is no system. Then it's, it's a free-for-all. So that's point number one.